Welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. Today we'll begin in a moment and speak with Joe Trento. And Joe Trento is an investigative journalist who has written a book, Prelude to Terror, The Rogue CIA and the Legacy of America's Private Intelligence Network. This is a book that's just been published. And it suggests that it tells the true story of the privatization of the CIA's covert operations and how these lawless activities resulted in the funding and fostering of our nation's terrorist enemies. Joseph Trento has written the most authoritative indictment ever of the CIA splinter groups, their recruitment of two generations of the Bush family into their illegal financial networks, and the blowback from their reckless actions, the funding and growth of terrorist organizations, including Al-Qaeda. So that sounds quite provocative and quite interesting. Then we'll be joined in the studio by Aaron Glantz, the author of a new book, How America Lost Iraq. And Aaron Glantz is a Pacifica reporter who covered the Iraq War. He's just back from Iraq. He's written this book, and his is a first-hand account of the alleged victory in Operation Iraqi Freedom. And he witnessed it turn sour into the quagmire that it's become. So he'll be joining us here in the studio. Then we'll talk with Gordon Davidson, who is the director of the Mark Taper Theatre, and he's also the director of a new play. It's called Stuff Happens, which is a play about a dramatization of the historic march to a preemptive war against Iraq, and it's written by playwright David Hare, directed by Gordon Davidson. He'll be talking to us in later in this hour. I'm speaking with Joe Trento, the author of Prelude to Terror, The Rogue CIA and the Legacy of America's Private Intelligence Network. And Joe, you're give us a thumbnail sketch of what you're claiming here in terms of a sort of privatized, off-the-shelf CIA, the one that Oliver North envisioned. It's been around for a long time, and it's recruited two generations of the Bush family. So could you walk us through this briefly?
Well, sure. I mean, this began really in the late 40s when the CIA was first created. Alan Dulles had come back from the OSS and had, in the couple of years before the end of the war and before the CIA was created, Dulles ran kind of private intelligence service using a lot of the good old boys who would later go into the CIA. And among the people that he had used and worked with was Prescott Bush, who had was the father to President George H.W. Bush and the grandfather of the current president. And these relationships became very important because Prescott's later elected to the Senate from Connecticut. He is in charge of an informal subcommittee that, in fact, has oversight over the CIA. And obviously, his influence is extremely important, and Alan Dulles understood that. And Alan Dulles then made a move on Prescott's son, George, and made a move through Zapata Oil, which was the company that George ran with the Overbees. They split off. They went and started a little company called Pennzoil, and George Bush stuck with Zapata, which was operating overseas
in Mexico, right? Yeah.
And Zapata was used by the agency in a lot of different ways, especially in Mexico and Central America. But that's sort of the glamorous part of what this private CIA is. The less glamorous is that a lot of people in the Directorate of Operations or Directorate of Plans, as it used to be known, decided that the best way to avoid congressional oversight after the 1970 Church Committee hearings was to, in fact, set up a private network of businesses and business fronts that would not be accountable to Congress. And the story I tell in Prelude to Terror is the story of how a number of governments were used in this effort, including the Saudis, who helped finance it. And the House of Saud helped pay for setting up some of these operations through banks like BCCI. Earlier, we used a bank called Nugan Hand, and a lot of your listeners may be familiar with the Riggs Bank scandal here in Washington of late. But these were front banks that allowed the CIA to operate these businesses privately with almost no accountability and no congressional oversight. This has now become the modus operandi for intelligence for the United States. But when you do this, when you operate with the convenience of no oversight, you suffer one other problem. That means you don't have a counterintelligence system. You don't have a way of making sure the foreign intelligence agencies and private businesses you work for are clean and not working for the bad guys. And, of course, as we learned so tragically with 9/11, Saudi intelligence, the GID, had people working for the bad guys. And when that happens, you can get very unpleasant surprises, as we did on 9/11.
And tell me about how the renegade agent, Wilson, who was put away, they threw away the key.
Yeah.
They just had to release him recently, I believe.
Yeah, because everybody lied.
So he was with a group called Task Force 186, wasn't it, or something?
Yeah, that was one of the many. Ed Wilson was a guy who originally started off on the U-2 project. Ex-Marine joins the agency and is brilliant at setting up front companies, business companies. And Wilson's bosses are people like, legendary people like Ted Shackley, the blonde ghost that David Korn wrote about, and Tom Clines, who's still a legend and still operating. And Wilson began to make lots of money. In 1968, he was compromised by a Soviet agent. And he had to leave the CIA, and they set him up with an unofficial cover. And Wilson then became sort of a business front, operating task force, I think it was Task Force 187 for the Navy, using various boats to map the seas for targeting for the Trident missile systems and the Poseidon missile systems, doing very important work, and in the process making a hell of a lot of money. Wilson was the perfect example of how you do it right. Unfortunately, his colleagues at the CIA began to get a little jealous, and they're seeing this guy become a millionaire. He bought a horse farm in horse country in Virginia and Upperville and was doing very well, and they decided, well, they wanted a cut of that. They wanted a piece of that. And they began to figure out ways of taking over his business. And when the Reagan administration came in, that became the perfect way to do that. And these guys began, Ted Shackley, Clines, the others, began operating the off-the-books operations for the Reagans, Iran-Contra, Iraq-8, and Ed Wilson began to have the FBI breathing down his neck. He was ordered by the CIA to operate in Libya, yet the fellow that he was sending in the reports and orders to was telling the FBI that he was a rogue agent. And they managed to lie about this to the point where Wilson was arrested, entrapped on a trip back from Europe to the United States, arrested, put into prison, accused of killing his prosecutors, and all of it was not true. It was all made up by the government.
I remember interviewing the prosecutor at the time.
Larry Barcella,
yeah.
Yeah, they're all very proud of it. And they said, oh, great prosecution. They all became heroes. Peter Moss wrote a great book that he had hoped was going to be made into the movie On the Hunt for Ed Wilson. The only problem is none of it was true. And Ed Wilson was sentenced to 50-some-odd years in jail, and only last year, a very brave judge, Lynn Hughes in Texas, along with a former CIA agent who was his lawyer, finally got the documents that got to the bottom of it, and Ed Wilson was ordered released. Now, ironically, he's not allowed to talk to any of the people he ever did business with, but I can tell you that some of them, including Tom Clines, are actively operating for the U.S. government in Iraq today.
And, well, why not? Iraq is the biggest
money in the
raid
bank.
On the treasury.
Right.
I mean, they're throwing money around in that place, you know, Halliburton, Taney's company among them. Joe, I remember talking to you a while back about, you were telling me about the, it's now the now famous trips, there was testimony recently in the Congress from the British MP, George Galloway, who just made absolute fools of the senators.
There was an amazing performance.
He at one point in the thing, they were trying to say, you know, that he was a toady of Saddam's, an apologist for Saddam's. And he said, Senator, I've only been to Iraq twice, the exact number of times that your Donald Rumsfeld went. But I was trying to bring humanitarian aid, and he was bringing guns and satellite maps to target those guns. And I remember talking to you a while back about the deals that Rumsfeld made with Saddam and the kickbacks that went. Didn't you tell me that Nixon was involved in some of the kickbacks?
We tell the story in Prelude. What happened was Sarkis Soghenaian, a Lebanese arms dealer, is who we used as our cutout to Saddam early on. And he worked with Kamel Adam, who was the late head of the Saudi intelligence service and a very wealthy man in his own right. And the Saudis, things hadn't changed. We were doing what they asked us to do. And it was very important for them to support Iraq in the Iran-Iraq war because they wanted to have a balance where these two countries would be occupied, and it would also give their Wahhabis something to do, other than to try and overthrow the royal family, which is a constant problem. So they got the United States and the Bush and Reagan administration, the first George Bush president, to throw in with this special effort to aid Saddam. And I was on one flight in 1984 on this arms dealer's airplane, where we brought in CIA people, satellite equipment, and other communications people to set up the first communications with Saddam. And this was an amazing thing because on the plane were a group of people called, I think the company was called Global Consultants, and the partners were Spiro Agnew, John Mitchell, the former attorney general and Watergate crook, and they were going to supply new uniforms for the Iraqi army. What Soghenaian told me later was that he could only be allowed to deal with Saddam if he agreed with the Reagan administration's instructions to give these people as much business as they wanted. And that meant things like this uniform deal, which turned out to be a disaster. What happened was Richard Nixon wrote his old friend, the dictator Ceausescu, and said, would you meet my former staff people, including a colonel named Jack Brennan and others, who will come to you about making uniforms for the Iraqi army in your country. And Ceausescu said, sure, Dick, I'll be glad to do this. And the letter's actually quite funny. And the uniforms ended up being made in Romania when they were supposed to have been made in Tennessee. And when they got the uniforms, the Iraqi uniforms came in, they were so bad and so heavy and so unsuited for desert warfare that the general called Soghenaian in my presence and said that Saddam was threatening to shoot him for this, and they could not possibly pay this $400 million for these uniforms that Nixon arranged for. There was later a lawsuit in which all of this came out. Soghenaian won the lawsuit when he refused to pay for the uniforms, and the Nixon's letters showed up in the lawsuit. So sometimes a little bit of truth emerges.
Give us a sense of how you've sourced all this.
Just on the sourcing, my sources included, in terms of the Iraqi stuff and his father and this other material, I interviewed Ed Wilson, I interviewed Sarkis Soghenaian, I interviewed all the people in business with Soghenaian, I interviewed many of the top Iraqi officials at the time, as well as the American officials at the time, and I witnessed a lot of this personally. What I do with my books, and my wife Susan is also an author, does the same, is we just use the shoe leather and go talk to people and get as many documents as we can to verify. You know, you're not always going to get the whole truth, and any reporter expects that. It's always going to be a moving target, but you do the best you can by talking to as many people as possible within the deadlines, and that's what we do.
And you befriended Colonel Bill Corson, right?
Yeah,
Bill Corson. Interviewed in the past, but
yeah, Bill Corson for many years. Bill and I and Susan co-authored a book called Widows, right. And then when Bill passed away in 2000, we inherited all of Bill's files, which were voluminous. He also had another friend who worked at the agency named Bob Crowley, and Crowley was sort of the inside guy, and Corson was the outside guy in the field. And we inherited Crowley's files as well. They were helpful, but nothing beats actually talking to those involved directly. Now, I want to, for those of you who think that when you deal with the United States and you do favors for them, everything is dandy and you're going to get rich, I'll give you an object lesson. Sarkis Soghenaian, that arms dealer who supplied Saddam, that guy who was absolutely necessary to our Mideast foreign policy in the 80s, and early 90s was flying to the United States in February for a visit for treatment for diabetes. He's 79 years old now. When he landed at the airport, he was going to meet with some FBI agents because he was going to help them on some of Saddam's stolen art. And the new Homeland Security Department took him and threw him into Chrome Detention Center, where he remains to this day. untreated medically. So if the Bush administration doesn't like you or the fact that you might tell stories about them, they're not going to be very nice to you. And that's Soganayan's current position. So if you want to look him up, you can go to the Chrome Detention Center in Miami and find him.
And you also deal with the October surprise scenario, do you not?
Yes, I...
which I is how Carter was hung out to dry and how Reagan got...
Well, Carter had disloyal people working for him.
Right.
And we had first uncovered this, strangely enough. My wife and I had done a book called Prescription for Disaster about the space shuttle Challenger. And in that book, we ran into Hans Mark, a former secretary of the Air Force, who told us, surprisingly, this is many years ago, that during the Reagan administration, that he was the one who slipped the foreign policy briefing book to the Reagan White House, Reagan campaign, excuse me. And I was sort of in a state of shock. He talked about it like it was nothing. And he would later come back to be a NASA official as a reward for helping the Reagan campaign. But that was the first time I had heard something that seemed right to me in terms of this. And then later, I had done a number of stories. One of the stories in Prelude to Terror is the story of this African-American young man, David Belfield, who becomes a terrorist. He actually conducts an assassination, he thinks, for the Ayatollah in Washington. And Belfield goes over to Iran in 1980 when he escapes after doing this killing. And he begins to get involved in Iranian politics at the highest level. And he learns details of the October surprise that are quite surprising. But
they're in your book, right?
Yeah, they're in the book, and we tell the story that there was a payment, a large payment made between the Iranian government by not the Republican Party, but by people close to the Republican Party, of in excess of $15 million.
Well, Joe, I thank you very much for joining us and for your book, Prelude to Terror, the Rogue CIA and the Legacy of America's Private Intelligence Network. I thank you for joining us and for your book, and I'm sure it's going to fly off the shelves.
Well, thank you very much.
Because it sounds like you've given us a taste of you tying a lot of threads together here of much of what we sort of know. We have a hunch that all of this chicanery went on, but it's important to be able to get it explained and in clear black and white. And I thank
well,
you for
I appreciate it.
Thank you, Joe.
Okay, take care.
Bye-bye. Hello again, I'm Ian Masters, just speaking with Joe Trento, the author of Prelude to Terror, the Rogue CIA and the Legacy of America's Private Intelligence Network. Aaron Glantz is in the studio with me. He's just back from Baghdad. His book, How America Lost Iraq, and Aaron literally was an eyewitness to this disaster where Operation Iraqi Freedom. By the way, you know that, Aaron, that Operation Iraqi Freedom, the original acronym that the Pentagon came up was Operation Iraqi Liberation, until somebody pointed out that that spells O-I-L. And they figured that wasn't exactly inappropriate, so they changed it to Operation Iraqi Freedom.
Well, that's quite something.
Again, Aaron Glantz is in the studio with me. And as we were saying earlier, you were unilateral. You were not embedded, which is incredibly risky. And I just was noticing the other day, you know, the Newsweek correspondent in Iraq just left. And he said something that was really interesting. He said that the American military there are so incredibly aggressive, not just to the Iraqi people, but to the Americans, to the press, to visiting dignitaries, to American officials. That, you know, he said that any number of occasions he's almost been shot and harassed. And you know the head of CNN got fired because he said that they're targeting journalists when – as far as I'm concerned, if you put somebody in the crosshairs of your gun, you're targeting them. So I don't know how he misspoke, but...
Well, I mean, as a journalist on the ground in Iraq, I can tell you that I have never feared for my life from the resistance. You know, I have contacts in the resistance. They know who I am, and they're not about to kill me. But I have feared for my life from American soldiers on a number of times. I have had guns pointed at me by American soldiers. I don't believe they did it on purpose, but it is part of this very hostile atmosphere,
They're
overall.
Angry, aren't they? They don't want to be there. They're angry at these people. They think they came to liberate them, and there they're shooting them in the back. I mean, they've been put into harm's way by these incompetents in the White House, and they've got to be mad. I mean, give us a feeling about what the guys think.
Well, I mean, I haven't spent a lot of time with U.S. soldiers since those early days when the atmosphere between American soldiers and Iraqis was better. I can tell you what it looks like from the other side of the gun, you know, from the Iraqi perspective. When an American tank breaks down on the highway, as happens from time to time, they close the whole highway, you know, just to make sure that nobody can get even close to the American. Now, you know, you just imagine you're sitting in Los Angeles and they just close down the 405 for 7 hours, you know, because of one foreign military vehicle. And in the meantime, you're sitting at home and it's 125 degrees and you have no electricity and you don't have a job because the situation has gone down so bad that nobody has a job, 70% unemployment in Iraq. And you're afraid to send your children to school for fear that they might get killed, although by now you're sending them to school off and on just because you can't have them pulled out of school forever, you know. But you do have an RPG-7 in your house, which you bought in those early days after the arm caches were looted, you know, by the Iraqi people. So you were able to buy an AK-47 for $10 on the street, as I saw people doing this in Fallujah, in Baghdad, you know. I mean, is it any wonder that we have the situation we have today? And, you know, just kind of further talk about how terrible the atmosphere is between the Iraqi people and the Americans today. I mean, it's really declined significantly since this book, How America Lost Iraq. It ends after the siege of Fallujah, where I think we really lost the Iraqi people at that point, and everyone supported the resistance. Just 2 weeks ago, Mohsen Abdelhamid was arrested by the U.S. military. He's a very prominent Iraqi politician. He was appointed to the governing council.
They've subsequently apologized, but there's no explanation for why.
Well, of course not, because they're constantly arresting people and releasing them. And this is the story. I don't believe they arrested him on purpose, but the fact is they arrested him, and hundreds of people, this is happening to them every week.
I have a theory, and you were there, so you can correct me. It seems to me that they allegedly won the war, what, April the 9th or thereabouts. It seems like but after the looting, by about April the 12th, it seems to me that's when they lost it, because people who have been traumatized by 35 years of a psychopathic mafia kind of family that living in what used to be referred to as the Republic of Fear, the new guys in town had to assure the Iraqi people that they were there, that they were going to protect them, and that the bad guys weren't going to come back in the middle of the night. So little wonder that we never provided the Iraqis with any assurances, any security, even to go outside their door. So why is it surprising that they don't trust us and they never sided with us? Because, you know, we know how ruthless the jihadis are and the ex-Baathists, you know.
Well, I mean, I went to Fallujah, as I said, May 1st, 2003, the same day that George Bush landed on the USS Abraham Lincoln off the coast of San Diego.
And declared mission accomplished.
That's right. And, you know, why did I go to Fallujah on that day? Why did I just hop in a taxi from Baghdad with a French colleague and land in the center in the chicken market of Fallujah, actually, and walk around on that Friday? Well, because earlier in that week, the U.S. military had fired into a crowd of people protesting the fact that their school had been turned into a U.S. military base, and they had killed 12 people and no American soldiers had been injured. And then when people went out for the funeral the next day, Americans again fired into the crowd and killed people. So I went on that Friday, you know, and I thought, you know, as often happens in the Arab world, that the imams of Fallujah would send people out into the streets, you know, and urge them to protest. But that's not what happened. You know, the imams of Fallujah were telling people that Islam was a religion of peace and that even though the Americans had done some bad things, that they were going to negotiate an end to this. What I think happened was that it was impossible to negotiate a good situation under occupation because for some reason, which we're still finding out, maybe you're covering it here on Background Briefing, the military of the United States had no intention of giving democracy to the Iraqi people, which is what they really wanted. So instead of organizing an election, they hired a company called the Research Triangle International and gave them almost $500 million to appoint who should be on the local government in every city. And then Muqtada Sadr, who we now see as this terrorist on TV, but who actually comes from a prominent political family in Iraq, he organized elections together with other political parties. And the people that he elected in those elections that people participated in ended up having to have gun battles with those appointed by RTI. Then, after that, you have these regular U.S. military patrols through neighborhoods taking people away to Abu Ghraib. And so I went to a village called Abu Sifa in March of 2004. 9 months earlier, The U.S. military had come to this area looking for one prominent Ba'athist, but they didn't know who he was. So they arrested all the men in Abu Sifa. Before they did that, they came to the largest house in town. They thought it was his. They ordered everyone out of the house. They fired a round of bullets from the machine gun on the top of the tank. They fired two shots from the barrel of the tank, destroying the house. It was the wrong house. Then they rounded up 83 men in this village with about 100 men and took them to Abu Ghraib. And when I visited the village 9 months after the raid, only one person of those 83 had been released. He was a 15-year-old boy. He had never had any trial, never been allowed to see a lawyer. And the stories that he told me before the Abu Ghraib prison scandal broke in this country were that he had not been allowed to sleep, that pebbles had been thrown at him all night long, that every night a different dog had been put into his cell until he complained to the International Red Cross, and that finally he was released, actually, only because his mother bribed the Iraqi police to get him out. And this was a 15-year-old boy, and this was happening all the time. And then, on top of that, if you want to talk about how America lost Iraq, after the four security officers from Blackwater Security were killed in Fallujah on March 31st, 2004, and their burning bodies were held over the Euphrates River, in the center of Fallujah, George Bush vowed revenge. The kind of revenge that he got was extremely brutal. You know, I interviewed a 12-year-old boy. His 11-year-old best friend was gunned down in front of his school. Ambulances were shot at. I saw a 73-year-old woman who had been shot in the neck. I interviewed a man who went out to get food aid from a neighborhood mosque, and the U.S. military had shot him just below the collarbone, and he was very lucky they missed because they aimed for the neck. The U.S. military killed so many people in Fallujah that the municipal football stadium had to be turned into a mass graveyard. And I visited that football stadium. And let me tell you, people were upset about the mass graves of Saddam Hussein. Now they have the mass graves of America. This is no way to make friends.
Well, Aaron, try and explain this to me, because I had a couple of weeks ago one of the senior State Department people who was in charge of the reconstruction plans. You know, a lot of money was spent, taxpayers' money, 11 agencies were involved, fairly elaborate plans were drawn up for the occupation of Iraq and the pacification and the economic reconstruction. And nothing was done. The Pentagon shelved all of these plans. The neocons kicked anybody out who knew about the Arab world. They considered them subversive because they're so pathetically tied to the Israeli right, that anybody that's not, speaks Arabic is therefore suspect. I mean, that's how nutty the neocons are, particularly Doug Feith, who was apparently in charge of vetting who went into Iraq. So the guy that I had on, David Phillips, explained this whole thing, this disaster that happened, and he just thought that his only explanation for why they did what they did was that it was just plain hubris on their part, that they honestly believed that it was just a regime change thing. All you had to do was get rid of Saddam, put in Chalabi, the Iraqi people would greet you and think you were great, and everything would be hunky-dory.
Well, you know, it was really incredible in those early days because, in May of 2003, most people were still supporting the idea that a foreign power had to come to get rid of their dictator, you know. But I would ride around in taxi cabs, and the taxi drivers would always say, "We love America, but we don't understand why they're trying to give us Ahmet Chalabi. You know, we don't understand. Maybe you can explain it to us." And I would say, "Well, people in America don't understand this either." I mean, I don't know. All I can tell you is what it looks like from the other side, from the other side of the gun. I went to Bakuba, where there's a very large military base about halfway between Baghdad and the Iranian border. And this was in April of 2004, during the siege of Fallujah. And I talked to this former Ba'athist general. And this guy was not one of those former regime elements that you hear them talking about. He was a career soldier who had worked his way up. But because he was a general in Saddam's army, he had this unique ability to negotiate between the resistance and the Americans. So he went with these two senior sheikhs in Bakuba, and he said, "Listen, we will stop shooting at you if you give us jobs in the reconstruction, because unemployment is over 70%, and you stop these military patrols in our neighborhoods, we will stop shooting at you." And that was refused by the U.S. military. These kinds of stories come up all the time, you know, in Iraq, and that's the explanation that I have.
But Aaron, the military themselves, they don't want to be shot. They know that they're targets there. they're apparently angry as hell. That's what we were talking earlier. The Newsweek guy said that they, you know, they'll beat anybody up. They're just so amped up and so pissed off, you know, that they're there in the first place. So why would that be so? Why would they have counterintuitive tactics?
Well, I think that the attitude of the U.S. military leadership in Iraq is that where there's terrorists, we need to kill them. Mm. But that's very counterproductive, you know, because they go to a village like Abu Sifa, right, and they arrest every man looking for the terrorists, and they keep all of them. And, of course, they all have families who then join the resistance. You know, the man who I told you about before who had been shot right below the neck, he said, I would have never thought about joining the armed resistance before, but now that I've been shot, I will fight till the last breath I have to get rid of the U.S. military. Recently, the U.S. military started bombing Al-Qaim, which is the city near the Syrian border where apparently some of these foreign jihadis had been taken up. And the sheikhs in this area, they actually called the U.S. military to let them know that these foreigners, who they didn't want them, were there. U.S. military responded by bombing the city and killing a lot of members of the same sheikh's family. And this is the way a cycle of violence develops. And this is why I think the only thing to do at this point is to leave Iraq, because let me look at the issue of electricity. In the beginning, we had the option to restore the electric grid in Baghdad. Even now, 2 years later, the electric grid is on a 3 hours on, 3 hours off system. It goes on for 3 hours. It goes off for 3 hours, 24 hours a day in Baghdad. In northern Iraq, where there's peace and has been peace the entire time, there's only 3 or 4 hours of electricity a day in Iraq. Now, we hired Bechtel Corporation. Bechtel took its sweet time getting started on all of this. Now, we could, like, shift gears and do something new, but we can't anymore because now the electric grid itself is part of the war. The resistance attacks the electric grid because it's an embarrassment to the occupation that the electricity doesn't work. And the only way for that situation to end, for the electric grid to actually be rebuilt, is for America to leave, to take this kind of basic services issue, you know, out of the realm of guerrilla warfare.
Hmm. But this is a valuable book. You risk your life to tell this story on a number of occasions. So,
you know, if you want people to be able to go to Fallujah and find out what's really happening, you know, when the U.S. military says they're going after terrorists, if you want someone to actually go to the graveyard, you know, that's been created and find out who is buried there, that it is women and children and the elderly and not foreign jihadis, as the Bush administration says, then the only way to have that happen is, you know, to do this kind of work, you know.
Except the people in the green zone who don't go outside the hotels. They send their drivers out to get stories for them, you know.
No, it's almost, I mean, I have great respect for anyone working in any way in Baghdad now. It's extremely dangerous. But it also comes down to, you have some great journalists over there who see some important stories and they can't get them printed. You know, Pacifica is a media outlet where once you have the information, you can go to the air with it.
Right.
A
best example of what you're saying, Aaron, is the private memo from the Wall Street Journal reporter she sent to her friends. And it was so different from what was the stories that the Wall Street Journal published. She told the truth about what a disaster it was.
And then she was taken off the job.
Then she was taken off the job, yeah. But give us a sense, though, Aaron, of you know, I don't blame the military. I think that Bush has put them in an impossible situation. I blame him and Rice and Cheney and Rumsfeld and that whole kind of criminal gang that are just ignorant and arrogant, and I don't even know why this guy went to war. It was an optional war. Some people think it was to prove something to his daddy. Who knows what his real motives were, because he kept changing his mind. He kept changing his story. That's where the focus ought to be. But just try and navigate this thing. I don't understand how our military could be doing such stupid, counterproductive things over there. It's never going to work. They're never going to have permanent bases there. They're going to be driven out of there. It's just obvious that the days are numbered, and it's getting worse and worse every day, and more people are joining the resistance.
Well, you know, what the Bush administration doesn't understand is that the more that they shoot at people, the more enemies they make. It's kind of a basic kindergarten lesson, you know. It's like the way it was explained to me recently is, if you kill somebody's, you know, if you kill one person in one village, then they have two brothers, they have like 18 cousins, and now they're all in the resistance. But the Bush administration thinks that the more people they kill, the less terrorists there are, because they're killing terrorists. Mm. And this is the problem. This is the basic problem. It's been this way since the very beginning, when we shot into a peaceful demonstration in Fallujah and killed 12 people because we were nervous,
I see. So I'd heard this story that the reason that with the stupidest things that Bush has said and done, mission accomplished on May the 1st where on the aircraft carrier, was bad enough. But not too much later, after the insurgency began, he said, "Bring it on," which was one of the most hideously irresponsible and stupid things he's ever said. And I understand that he was given briefings saying, "This is really neat. We're in Iraq, and all the jihadis are flocking in, and we're just going to be shooting fish in a barrel."
Well, a lot of Iraqis that I talk to, you know, I mean, you know, people over there are just trying to make sense out of it the same way you and I are. Yeah. And, you know, a lot of people look back to this idea that he said, you have to stay on the offensive. You have to take the battle to them. And a lot of Iraqis are really angry at the Bush administration because they think that the Bush administration is established at Baghdad is going to be the magnet for international terrorists, and that we're going to try to find them over there to make sure that they don't bomb us in this country. But, you know, what they don't understand about that kind of rationale is now there's 25 million Iraqi people who are increasingly sympathetic to the idea of killing Americans, you know. And I should just say that when I first got to Iraq, you know, people understood, you know, that there's a lot of dissent in this country. But now the lack of big demonstrations in this country over the tremendous violations of human rights happening in Iraq, you have a lot of people, you know, saying, why is it, you know, that nobody is protesting?
In terms of what's happening now, how the bloggers have sort of tried to keep the Downing Street memo alive and, you know, even offering up $1,000 to a reporter who asked the question. Finally, the question was asked. Now, today in the Sunday Times of London, there's an adjunct to the Downing Street memo, a briefing paper that's apparently at the same meeting that's been leaked, that indicates that Bush and Blair met in Crawford in April of 02, where Bush told Blair, "We're going to go to war." And that's it. And now, so it's sort of exploded that myth that they, as they said in their press conference last week. Aaron Glantz, thank you very much for joining us today in Los Angeles and for your book, How America Lost Iraq. Let's now go to a discussion with the play Stuff Happens, is written by the English playwright David Hare, directed by Gordon Davidson. Its American premiere is at the Mark Taper, and it features Tyrese Allen, Henry Brown, Jane Carr, Keith Carradine, Mitchell Edmonds, Brian George, Kip Gilman, James Gleason, Francis Guinan, James Handy, Jay Harrick, John Michael Higgins, Anna Hadja, John Rafter, John Rafter Lee, Dakin Matthews, Paul Messenger, Alan Oppenheimer, Julian Sands, I believe he plays Tony Blair, Stephen Spinella, Lorraine Toussaint, she plays Condoleezza Rice, Inga Tudor, and John Vickery. And we're joined by Gordon Davidson, who is the director of the play Stuff Happens, which is at the Mark Taper Theatre, written by David Hare. I just ran down the cast, and the play's historic march to a preemptive war against Iraq is told in riveting detail by playwright David Hare. And you've directed the American premiere of this play. Am I correct in assuming here that because of the lack of courage on the part of our press in this country in reporting the lead-up to this war and stimulating a necessary public debate about the most important issues that governments and peoples face, which is going to war, that it has fallen to the artistic community to belatedly stimulate a debate?
I do believe that in this kind of society that we live in, where we are free to express ourselves, and even often in repressive societies, the arts can be right at the barricade in doing, asking the questions that need to be asked. And I feel that that's the case of David's play, which I think is a brilliant play. Some people have asked me, well, why bother doing it now? We know all of that, and we're you know, they've moved on. They haven't had an election. They're trying to, you know, create a constitution, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And I think it's all the more necessary to do a play like this because, first of all, it asks very challenging questions for which there are no easy answers. But it's better that those questions get asked in a room, which I call the theater, where the artists, the actors, and the playwright and an audience come together to experience those the particular build up to the war and how we went to war, so they can ask the right questions when they go out. It's a dialogue. It's a kind of town meeting. It's a kind of experience that you can't get anywhere else. You can't get it watching a television screen and watching another edition of Frontline or Nightly News, you know? It's a participatory sort of experience in which the audience is as much a part of it as the actors and the playwright. And that's the spirit in which I said, let's do it. Let's go to work on it. First of all, it's been a great lesson for all of us who are working on it because we've studied a lot, and David Hare had done even more extensive study. There are lots of issues that are unresolved.
Well, God knows, today in the London Times, Sunday Times, an adjunct to the Downing Street memo was broken, and which is a briefing paper. So it's added to the debate. So anybody who says that the subject of your play stuff happens is yesterday's news. I mean, it's still breaking news.
Absolutely, absolutely. In so many ways, in unpredictable ways, and will continue to be so. So I have no fear about that, and I don't think that most of the audience feels that way. But, you know, the other interesting thing about the way David structured the play is that he does allow for many different points of view to exist simultaneously in the play, both in the telling of the factual story, in the imagined scene that he created in the Oval Office and in 10 Downing Street and Camp David and UN, behind the scenes, as it were. Those are acts of imagination, but they ring so true that you have to believe that either he had inside track or he's a very intuitive person, and both may be true. and all of that leads up to the notion that these are onions that you can still keep peeling back and finding the center. And just like Deep Throat suddenly emerged so many years after the Watergate, things will come out that we will understand better that the decision to go to war had been made even prior to any attempts to get the UN backing and to have the inspections for weapons of mass destruction, and that there were no weapons of mass destruction, et cetera, et cetera. So the reason for going to war, I think, even with as good a play as this is not solved. It just says it in effect says there were other reasons.
Mm. Well, Gordon, I don't know how a playwright or you, a director, or anybody could come up with a definitive answer to the reason we went to war, simply because the White House itself, the architects of this war, they've never gotten their story straight.
Well,
maybe 1 minute it was WMD, the next minute it was getting rid of a tyrant, the next minute it's bringing democracy. I mean, it's been a moving target.
Yes, exactly. And that's what we try to convey in the play, that the ground shifts very easily from... Cheney has a wonderful scene near the end of the first act where he says, I'll go along with this, but let's turn it to the UN, crisis at the UN rather than any policy decision on the part of the United States.
Hmm.
And a lot of those tactics still work. They're very, very good at doing that.
And yeah, if only they were good at governance as they are at intimidating the opposition and manipulating the press, we'd be the country would be in much better shape. Gordon, I thank you so much for joining us.
So we're opening a play called Apollo, which also is an interesting thing about the German scientists who worked on the Apollo mission.
Oh, really?
And the fact that many of them were Nazis, and how we in that time thought that it was more important to win the race to the moon than deal with the issues of the fact that they were part of the enemy and part of the problem. Very interesting subject.
But
at the Kirk Douglas Theater. But that happens, I think, has been a very rewarding experience, and it's clear that the public wants to be in the room with everyone else and part of the dialogue, and I thank you for talking about the play.
Well, and I also thank you, and the Mark Tabor Stuff Happens, written by David Hare and directed by our guest Gordon Davis. And again, I thank you for joining us today in Los Angeles, Gordon.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. Hello again, I'm Ian Masters, just speaking then with Gordon Davison, who's the director of the play Stuff Happens, and he's also the director of the Mark Taper Theatre, long-time director of the Mark Taper Forum, and also now the Kirk Douglas Theatre in Culver City as well.
I thank Louis Vandenberg for the research and producing this program. I thank the engineer, Mark Maxwell. This program can be heard on ianmasters.org, on the net, ianmasters, one word, .org. Bye for now.